You're listening to Heartland on Illinois Edition. I'm Rachel Otwell, joined by my co-host, Kyle Isham. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Rachel.
This is our regular segment where we look at spirituality and matters of the heart. Today we'll be doing that with a visit to a local leader in the Islamic community.
There's uncertainty as to what a Trump presidency is going to look like, and we are afraid. And that is the overwhelming sentiment that we feel.
Then we'll be speaking with someone who was part of an interfaith trip to Standing Rock in North Dakota earlier this month.
After this election, I think a lot of people are really trying to figure out, how do we live together in this United States? And part of it is, how do we get out there into living meaningful lives?
And so part of the way we considered going about this episode was that obviously this is coming after the election. And for a lot of people, I think that came with the realization that some of the deep divides in this country are even deeper than maybe some of us suspected.
There is a lot of just vitriol going out. And even people who would have similar views began infighting and turning against one another because there was just such a profound sense of frustration. And so the people we talked with on today's episodes, they're finding ways to bridge those gaps and to bring a kind of unifying element that helps us all remember that we are united in this life together, not only by acknowledging what we have in common, but what we don't have in common. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's what makes us individuals, and that isn't inherently oppositional to us getting along and being able to see each other's perspectives and honor the diversity that is inherent in life.
And so that brings us to our first conversation with Ali Nizamuddin. He's the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. He also teaches politics at the University of Illinois Springfield. We weren't able, just because of scheduling conflicts, we weren't able to meet him at the mosque, but I did attend a service there last year while doing a story, and I just wanted to share some of the audio that you would hear at a service at the local mosque in Springfield. So again, we're about to talk to Ali Nizamuddin. He was nice enough to allow us into his home, right, Kyle?
Yes, there was such a profound sense of being welcomed. And in his culture that he comes from, the guest is seen as a source of divinity. And that was really conferred upon us. We were served tea, we were offered lunch, and we were just very much made a part of his home.
And so we started the conversation talking with him about something that had popped up in the news within the last couple weeks, and that was a kind message that someone had chalked outside of the mosque, and we'll just get right into it.
Yes, yeah, somebody wrote in chalk that you are a most cherished part of our community. And so they drew flowers as well. And it's not the only incident. There have been several phone calls that people have left. There's a lawyer that called indicating that he would want to, for free, be a lawyer for us if we need his help with issues related to civil rights. So it's an overpouring of support from the overall Springfield community. At the same time, there have been incidents of hate as well, and people saying, you know, bad words like camel jockey or using the N-word, sand N-word, go home, those types of things. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the negative aspects that we have experienced. There is much more caution that we exercise as a result of the hysteria and the acrimonious election.
And how long has the mosque been in Springfield, and how did that get started?
So in 1981 was when the mosque became a non-for-profit 501c3 organization. And the original mosque was burned down in 1994 as a result of arson. And the FBI, the conjecture is that the FBI feels that it was somebody from Matthew Hales' organization, which is a white supremacist organization. And Matthew Hale currently is in jail. And so the mosque was burned down in 1994, and this mosque was built in 1999. And so we have been at that particular location at 3000 Stanton for the past 17 years. There's over 32 different ethnic communities within the mosque, so you have people from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, various parts of Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula. Our imam is Somali. You also have a lot of Africans, mostly West Africans. So it's an extremely diverse place. Everyone is welcome, irrespective of whether you're a Sunni or a Shia or any of the schools of thought unique to the Islamic faith.
And so you teach comparative analysis when it comes to
comparative cultures.
So knowing what you do from that angle and that history,
right?
Are you afraid of what the next 4 years could bring for your people of your faith?
I think everybody's afraid. The word that describes us is fear. We are scared. There's uncertainty as to what a Trump presidency is going to look like, and we are afraid. And that is the overwhelming sentiment that we feel. He has called for surveillance of Muslim neighborhoods. We simply don't know how he's going to govern. All we know is the people that he's surrounding himself with, and the lieutenant general that he just hired for the national security advisor. Michael Flynn called Islam a cancer. He didn't call Islamic radicalism a cancer. He said that Islam is a political ideology masking as a religion.
And we're here in your home. We met your two young children and your wife, who obviously wears a hijab.
Sure.
Have there been times when you fear for their safety before, or is this kind of a new era?
No, we have had these kinds of things. This is Tuesday for us. This is something that we have to deal with on a daily basis. And it's very sad that we have to do so because we are some of the most important members of our community. There are many professors. There are many doctors. There are so many Muslim businesses.
Do you tire of having to explain to people the difference between radical Islam?
Absolutely. I feel that I shouldn't have to because the KKK used the holiest symbol of Christianity to promulgate their hate, the cross. They invoked the Bible. And yet nobody said that we don't go to the Christians and say that, can you explain the KKK for us? We realize that they're a fringe group. We realize that they don't represent Christianity. They don't represent all white people. I feel that we shouldn't have to, but that is the reality of our times. And it is something that is also an opportunity for us to explain our faith to other people, for people who will listen.
And what is it about your faith or what facets of it give you the courage and strength to meet these challenges on a day-to-day basis?
Well, as any faith, we rely on a higher power that is greater than us. And we wish to be centered in the energy of that higher authority. Islam, like Christianity, believes in God, and the one God is greater than all of us, greater than our struggles, greater than our plights, and God is always constantly, constantly with us.
And so with that faith, how do you then reconcile some of the things that happen to people of your faith, particularly?
Anything that happens is a part of the divine plan. And if some harm befalls us, either God is testing us or God is punishing us. And the way we know if God is testing us or punishing us is to the extent that we return back to God. If I return back to God in surrender to God, accepting this as a part of the divine plan, that the God has a plan for me, then it is a test that I passed.
And so as the president of the local Islamic society, it seems like you focused on reaching out to other faiths.
Right.
Can you talk about why that's important to you?
We are all servants of God. We are children of God who belong to a common humanity. God doesn't want us to simply pray and to fast and to give in charity. We try to do a lot of outreach within the community at the St. John's Breadline, humanitarian work, as well as clothing drives and food drives and water drives for the people of Flint, for instance, is something that we did a few months ago. Well, this is important to us because it is a responsibility that we have as God's citizens on earth, God's representatives on earth.
So that was Ali Nizamuddin, and he is the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. He also teaches politics at UIS. Now we're moving on, though. I had been wanting to talk to somebody regarding Standing Rock and Native American spirituality for a while now. And as we know, within the last even week or two, the situation there has become more dire as the temperature has been going down. And things like water cannons have been used on the demonstrators there. And they're being asked to leave even by December 5th, according to an NPR report. The Army Corps of Engineers wants pipeline protesters out. I had reached out to the Standing Rock Sioux, which is the tribe there in North Dakota where this is taking place, trying to talk to someone. And it's not surprising at all. I haven't heard back just because of how busy people are there and how things are really changing on a regular basis, and it really seems like an all hands on deck sort of operation. But we were able to find someone who went there earlier this month, November 2nd through 4th, so much earlier this month. His name is Nick Cable. He was there for a couple days after driving to Standing Rock with 13 other people as part of an interfaith effort. Nick's from Milwaukee. He's training now in St. Paul, Minnesota to be a Unitarian Universalist minister. This is what he had to tell us about his time at Standing Rock.
The entire resistance is understood as a ceremony, as a constant act of prayer. There's very regularly prayer circles and Native American rituals from different traditions that were happening both centrally and disparate throughout the camp.
And can you talk about the overall environment at Standing Rock? You're talking about the prayers and rituals that were going on. Obviously, that's not the main thing that the media is concerned about. And a lot of what we're right. seeing makes it look like there's constant battle going on between police forces and the people there.
Yeah, and my sense, which is limited, was sort of that there is this main camp, the Ocheti Shakoi camp, that is where most of the tents are. There's a road that is lined with flags of different tribes and different religious communities and folks in solidarity with it. And you might see camps all over the kind of a general area. And then there's a road that goes to a bridge that's been blocked off. That bridge is kind of the site of a lot of the protests or the ceremonies where the water protectors kind of are wanting to have a stop to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is just about a half a mile or so, not exactly sure, up the way from that road. There is this sort of balance between deep beauty and the shared living and the existing kind of in the main camp, and then this very close standoff with, you know, armored vehicles and militarized officials and things like that. It creates a constant sense of uncertainty with how actions might go down, which I wasn't very keen on as just sort of a general person in the camp and not a leader of the camp by any means.
And could you explain your sense of spirituality and how it's expressed in your faith?
As a Unitarian Universalist, I believe in the power of love to kind of transcend issues of hate and division in the world. When we find communion with others by looking into the eyes of another, we can see that we are all kind of children of God. We all have a spark of the divine in us. Our interdependence as human beings, as people a part of the interdependent web of existence, is very meaningful to me. Coming to a place where there is a metaphorical shared table trying to be created of people coming together across differences is living into that deep belief that we're all connected, that we're not alone in this journey, and that we all have work to do in getting back to that sense of wholeness as one humanity.
And then, so I guess just full disclosure coming from my part, Nick, the way we know each other is that I was raised in the Unitarian Universalist faith. One thing I know about it, social justice is important. Getting involved as you did is important to the people who practice that. And especially with the election results we've seen and a lot of people somewhat reactionary, I guess, but coming to want to be more involved with politics. Is that something you're seeing within the Unitarian Universalist people you know, I guess?
Yes. After this election, I think a lot of people are really trying to figure out how do we live together in this United States? And part of it is how do we get out there into living meaningful lives? And I think that is, for Unitarian Universalists, always been a central question. Unitarian Universalists agree not on how we think alike, but about what kind of values we want to live into the world. And justice is central to that. Compassion is central to that. In this post-election world, the stakes feel so much higher for many of us of trying to find a way to meaningfully enact just reform in societies. I experience a lot of folks wanting to go out to Standing Rock. There's another a call for people to come this coming weekend. They're expecting thousands of people to come. There's also people who are organizing around being sanctuary congregations to help with immigrants and refugees, as well as the Women's March on Washington in late January. So there's a lot of intensity and urgency of making a difference right now.
And so what were some of the spiritual lessons you gained from this journey you took?
The lesson of Standing Rock is that vulnerability and courage are so closely aligned. The movement for resistance is very fragile, and yet there's so much strength of people coming together despite that vulnerability to be courageous in living out their values in the world. There can be kind of two worlds existing at once, that beautiful world of our strength and numbers of coming together across differences, and at the same time, a deep, fragile preciousness to how we sustain that vision of a different America, of a different world. Beyond the kind of intellectual learning about the context for these disputes, it's also about really trying to cross cultural boundaries by understanding what these differences in human experience are about and really honoring those differences, as opposed to trying to say, oh, we're all just sort of the same, or aren't we all just kind of exactly the same? I think by doing deeper intercultural competency work, we're able to see the nuances that make this a much more complicated endeavor than at first glance.
That was Nick Cable. He was talking about his own sense of spirituality as a Unitarian Universalist. He'll soon be a minister, but also about the trip that he took with people of several different faiths to Standing Rock in North Dakota to be part of the pipeline protestation that's going on there. But as he described, a lot of what's actually taking place involves prayer and Native American ritual. If you would like to learn more about the Standing Rock Sioux, by the way, their official website is standingrock.org. Earlier you heard from Ali Nizamuddin, who is the leader for the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. He had some valuable insight also because he teaches politics at the University of Illinois Springfield. So it may seem like we got a little political for this episode, being that this is about spirituality for the most part, Kyle, but we were talking about how, you know, for some people, there really is no disconnect between spirituality and the way they exist politically or in some sort of activist mindset.
Yeah, because it's still about each moment of life, that how you act in the world has meaning and value. You may not agree with someone's opinion, but you still see them as an essential part of this life and treat them with the dignity and respect and love and kindness that they deserve. And that you really let that inform your actions out in the world, because actions are of the utmost importance, and we must treat each other with respect.
For Heartland and Illinois Edition, I'm Rachel Otwell, and Kyle Isham is my co-host. And Kyle, you have a song that you're going to take us out on?
Yes, this is by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. He was a Qawwali singer from Pakistan, and he passed away in the late 90s, and his music is so full of love and reverence, and it just really gives you a great hope for the future. Yeah.